thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at Facebook.com/FisheriesPodcast, or support the podcast on Patreon at Patreon.com/FisheriesPodcast. Our guest today is Emily D'Souza. Emily is a graduate student in the Department of Geography at the University of Guelph. Her current graduate research is exploring values-based direct marketing arrangements in the seafood industry and how seafood value chains are being impacted by COVID-19. She is currently working on a podcast project with her advisor and another colleague, former guest Hannah Harrison, where they interview folks involved in the seafood industry to share their stories of how their seafood business is being impacted by COVID-19 and how they are adapting. Welcome to the podcast, Emily.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here and chat a little bit about fisheries and my work.
Well, I will admit that I don't know anything about the seafood industry, and I definitely don't know anything about values-based direct marketing arrangements. What exactly is that long term that I just said?
Yeah, so admittedly, I also did not know what values-based direct marketing was. It was an entirely new concept to me up until, I guess, the fall, and has now become the focus of my graduate research. But basically, direct marketing arrangements are referring to a situation where consumers are purchasing food directly from harvesters. So in fisheries, they're often called community-supported fisheries, and consumers are buying their seafood directly from fishermen. And this values-based piece that is often tagged onto the front of this is just kind of describing some of the reasons that folks gravitate towards direct marketing models. So in fisheries, for example, a lot of people tend to gravitate towards direct marketing in order to get a better price for their catch, to promote community ownership over fisheries resources, to promote sustainable fishing practices, and actually this values-based piece is kind of the focus of my research, is understanding what specifically motivates fishermen to pursue these models and a lot of the values associated behind it, because it definitely is driven by a lot of these different pieces.
And the other component of it was value chains. What is that?
Yeah, so value chains are basically referring to all the stops that a product is making before it gets to you. So with a traditional seafood value chain, it's super convoluted. There are a lot of people involved. You know, the product starts at the seafood harvester, is usually sold to a wholesaler, and then a processor, then a distributor, and then from there, it ends up usually in a restaurant or an export market, and then finally to a consumer. So with this direct marketing model that we were just talking about, they aim to shorten that value chain and eliminate all those middlemen, which is where we often see a lot of undesirable behaviors occurring in the seafood industry, like fraud and mislabeling, mistreatment of workers, etc. So the value chain is just kind of all those different moving pieces that happen, all the different steps that occur before that seafood actually ends up on your plate.
And we mentioned that you're looking at how these value chains are impacted by COVID-19. Was that originally part of your project, or did that just kind of fall in your lap with this global pandemic?
Yeah, it was not initially part of my project. So yeah, the pandemic definitely imploded my thesis a little bit. It's a super unfortunate situation that we're all in. It's also a really interesting time to be a student, and specifically with this work, you know, to be able to track things as they're happening. You know, it's a really unique position to be in and just see things as they're happening and as they're unfolding. I've had to shift the focus of my project a little bit. I just thought it would be poor research habits, I guess, to ignore it. You can't ignore it. The pandemic is having massive impacts on seafood value chains and on the seafood industry. And I mean, on all industries as a whole, but specifically, I think it's really exposing a lot of holes in our food systems and in our globalized systems. And so basically, I'm working with other colleagues in my lab and to understand, you know, exactly how the pandemic is influencing the seafood industry and these value chains. And from my point of view, I'm seeing two, I guess, like major areas of impact in terms of how COVID-19 is impacting the seafood industry. The first one being the loss of markets. And this actually happened like way earlier than I think a lot of people realize, even myself. This wasn't apparent until I started speaking to fishermen, because a lot of seafood that's harvested in North America is actually destined for export markets in Asia. And because that's where the where COVID-19 originated, a lot of those export markets were closed way before the coronavirus even hit North America or became as serious as it now is in North America. So fishermen lost export markets very, very early on, and then a couple months later lost their restaurant markets. And if you can imagine, you know, the volumes of seafood that are destined for export markets and restaurants, and a lot of other things like tourism, like cruise ships, fishermen have lost access to a lot of those markets where they would traditionally be selling the majority of their catch. And so now all they have is individual household, individual consumers to try to sell their catch to, which has been a struggle in itself, but also is obviously way less volume than what they would be selling to restaurants or cruise ships or export markets. And the second area that we're kind of seeing massive impacts is the processing industry and the processing piece of seafood. It seems to be creating this bottleneck in the supply chain at the processing stage. You know, obviously processing facilities are set up in a way that makes it super difficult to maintain social distancing. And as a result, most of them, and I'm speaking from a Canadian perspective, but most of them up until very recently were actually closed because, you know, they couldn't ensure that workers would be able to stay 6 feet apart or that they would have access to personal protective equipment. There was also we rely on a lot of foreign temporary workers for these processing facilities. And with all the border closures, there was like some confusion and some delaying with that. And then when borders did open up, they had to wait 14 days. And so the whole processing piece was a little bit of a bottleneck. And now, to my understanding, a lot of the processors are being able to open up. The government just announced some funding supports for them. So the processing facilities are slowly opening up with like all the proper safety guidelines in place, which is actually like causing another area of concern now, because I personally am wondering what's going to happen if all the fishermen go out and catch all the seafood, come back and bring it to a processor, and all these processors, you know, they do all the gutting, cutting the heads off, the filleting, all that stuff, and then freeze the fish because there's not enough demand right now to get rid of it all. And so the only option is to freeze it. So we're thinking a lot about the implications of having tons of freezers overflowing with frozen fish when those export markets and when those restaurant markets do open up, and how that's going to affect the price of seafood, and just some of those like long-term market implications and how things are going to kind of shake out over the next couple months.
Certainly sounds a lot like the media attention that the beef and pork and chicken processing plants are getting here in the U.S., but these fish processors aren't getting quite any of that media attention that these other ones are, but they're facing a lot of the same issues with being shut down because of the close working conditions and all that. Are any of the fish processing plants that have reopened, are any of them considered hot spots like some of these beef or pork processing plants are?
Yeah, so I've actually come across a couple different articles over the last few days where there have been processing plants that have had some outbreaks. I know like Alaska, they just had their first positive case, and then there was a processing facility in Oregon that was just shut down because of positive cases. And so, yeah, it's a really interesting situation like to have people trying to work under these conditions, and even with all these safety measures in place, like it's a really like big area of concern if it's enough, and yeah, how to keep people safe in that environment. And I have read a couple news articles where there have been confirmed cases in seafood processing facilities, which is obviously a very concerning and not what we want to be hearing.
Now, some of the commercial fishermen that have already switched to this direct marketing arrangements, are they doing better than some of the ones that sell solely to processing plants?
Yeah, so this is exactly what we're exploring in our lab right now. And actually the latest episode that we just filmed for our podcast is looking at like how fishermen have been able to adapt and what some of the like pre-existing conditions are that have enabled some to be more successful than others. And so those who, you know, for example, we speak with a fisherman from San Diego who has a dockside infrastructure to be able to sell their catch right off the boat. They have like the market infrastructure in place where people can line up at a safe distance. They have an online ordering system set up. And so they've been able to adapt really like fairly easily to the situation. Whereas some other fishermen who like in British Columbia, we don't have that sort of dockside infrastructure. There are no fish markets in BC. Also, there's no like fisheries that are really close to like a major city like Vancouver. A lot of the fisheries are a lot further out in rural communities, and so that poses another set of challenges. There are also different like processing rules about like how much processing fishermen can do on their boats or on the dock. And then there's a lot of permitting. And again, speaking from a Canadian perspective, there's some like regulations around permitting. And then if you want to sell seafood straight off of your boat, you need to acquire a permit, which I do understand has been a little bit easier to do lately because I think like the government is understanding that there is no other market. And so I know a lot of fishermen have been able to go out and acquire permits to sell right off the boat. But again, having to do so with limited processing, which might, in my personal opinion, like might pose some obstacles for seafood consumers. You know, that's kind of one of the barriers with seafood in general is consumer education and consumer awareness. And I personally, you know, I work in fisheries and seafood, and I wouldn't know what to do with a whole fish, but I also wouldn't want to like do the whole process of gutting a fish myself and having to descale it and all that good stuff. And it does take a lot of time. And especially for somebody who's unfamiliar with seafood products, it would, I think, be a turnoff to have to do all that themselves. So I think it's just posing another barrier with all these processing restrictions. But we have seen a lot of fishermen who have been successful in moving to direct marketing and finding different ways to reach consumers. And I'll also say that one positive thing that we are hearing consistently across the board from a lot of the fishermen that we're speaking to is that the community support has been like absolutely incredible. Like all of these fishermen that we've spoken to have just said the highest praise for the people in their local area who are rallying behind local fishermen and local food producers. And it's a change that I think all of us hope will stay for the long term, but it's been really positive to hear like how quickly communities are rallying behind their local food producers and are looking to support them now more than ever.
So we've mentioned it a few times already, once in the bio and once at the beginning of your last answer, but you've been able to share some of the stories of these commercial fishermen through a podcast, and almost 40 episodes ago, Hannah Harrison explained this project, but could you refresh our memory on what exactly the Coastal Roots Project is all about?
Yeah, so Coastal Roots is a collaboration of communities, scholars, activists, and others who are interested in supporting the health, resilience, and sustainability of coastal communities around the world. And so our latest project within Coastal Roots is this podcast project called Social Fish Distancing. And basically we chat with a group of fishermen, and we've kind of expanded the scope now. So we're also chatting with some processors and retailers and some folks that are working on like some apps to connect fishermen with consumers. And so we've brought in the scope to chat with a few different folks in the seafood industry, but we try to speak with them on a weekly basis and then use these interviews to track how COVID-19 is impacting the seafood industry and then share these stories in the podcast. And our goal is to really to amplify the stories of these fishermen and share, you know, how they're being impacted, how they're adapting, and just some of the changes and the struggles that they're dealing with, which again, like is often lost on the consumer, especially here where I'm based in Guelph. You know, obviously we're not a coastal area, and so it's very easy to often ignore these issues or not pay as much attention to them. It's kind of, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And so our goal with the podcast is to really change that and to get people thinking and talking about seafood and understanding what these fish harvesters are going through and how we can support them now and in the long term.
And how many of these episodes have you done already? Are they available now or will they be released later?
Yeah, so we have three episodes that are live now. We just actually recorded our fourth episode today. So we release a new episode every Tuesday, and they can be listened to on the Coastal Roots website, which is just www.coastalroots.org, or by searching up Coastal Roots Radio, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to podcasts, you should be able to find Coastal Roots Radio. And yeah, a new episode every single Tuesday.
And that isn't the only microphone that you've been in front of either. You've been fortunate enough to give a TED Talk. Was that something you were invited to do, or was it something you signed up for?
Yeah, I definitely love to talk. So I think I found my calling with all these podcasts and public speaking. But yeah, the TED Talk was a really, really awesome experience. And basically what happened with that was I had actually just come off of my first kind of major speaking engagement. The year prior, I spoke at the Women in Travel Summit in Milwaukee, and that was kind of my first like big public speaking event, and I was feeling really great about it, and I really enjoyed it and had a positive experience, and was basically looking for more opportunities to do that kind of outreach and engagement. And at the time, TEDx Canada, so just like it's a town just outside of Ottawa, they were holding auditions and looking for proposals for speakers for the next TEDx event. And so I had to submit, I think, like a written proposal, and I was invited to come to an in-person audition. And then after that, from that in-person audition, they picked eight of us to speak at the actual event. And at the time, I didn't really have high expectations of it. You know, I kind of thought that there was no way that I was going to get picked to do a TED Talk. And so my plan was to kind of like apply for a few until I got chosen to speak at one. So it was a really surreal experience. And it really catalyzed a lot of things for me. But so yeah, I spoke, that was back in, February of 2018, I think. And yeah, I spoke about plastic pollution in the oceans and kind of a similar thing to what I was just saying, you know, trying to bring some of these marine issues that are often not at the forefront of people's minds, you know, to the surface and facilitate this dialogue. And it was received really well, and really, I think, sparked a lot of conversation afterwards about plastic pollution and a lot of the different regulations around it and some of the implications of our plastic waste. So it was a really, really positive experience that I like to think had a good outcome and a good influence.
And you mentioned that TED Talk was kind of a catalyst for you. And around that same time, you founded the Youth Action on Climate Change. You and this group talk about a lot of these issues. I guess, how did this come about? Was it solely based off of responses you got from that TED Talk?
Yeah, I think, I guess that was a big year for me. I think I was definitely like, I've always been looking for ways to get involved, clearly, and to influence positive change and just, I guess, improve my community, improve the world. And so Youth Action on Climate Change was actually started, and it was initiated by a conversation that I had over dinner with a mentor of mine. We were chatting about youth movements and, you know, the power of young people. And this was around the time that the 21 youth in the U.S. were suing the U.S. government over their right to a clean environment. And the high school students in Florida were mobilizing following one of the school shootings that happened in Florida. And we were just seeing like this really powerful and overwhelming like youth movements that were just taking over, and we were kind of having a conversation about how we thought that youth were going to be the future, and we decided that we wanted to find these young people in our community. And you know, Guelph is a fairly progressive city and a fairly active city, especially on things like climate change. And so we knew that we had these people here, we just had to find them. So it started as kind of a little bit of an experiment, just to figure out who these young people were in our community, what they were looking for, how they felt about climate change, And what basically came out of the initial experiment was this overwhelming demand from young people for an outlet to take action. We were hearing things like, you know, I'm tired of writing essays about climate change. I want to actually do something. So Youth Action on Climate Change was born in response to that ask. And basically now we act as a community incubator that aims to empower youth voices on climate and also cultivate the next generation of environmental leaders. So we essentially provide resources and support to young people to actually develop and implement their own climate solutions in our community while also mixing in leadership training. So we work with high school students and university students, both at the undergraduate and graduate level. So there's this mentorship component, and we do leadership workshops like communication and public speaking, and we really encourage young people to be critical of ideas and to challenge people. And then the other piece of what we do is really focused on this mobilizing youth to take action. So we have been around for about a year and a half now, and we've just wrapped up our first project in Guelph, which was focused on active transportation. And so young people are really passionate about getting youth cycling more in Guelph and addressing some of the safety concerns around active transportation in our city. So this is where we focused our very first project on. And our next project was going to be in the same vein, looking at public transit and how we could get youth feeling more comfortable taking the bus and things like that. Unfortunately, that project was cut short by the pandemic and was kind of cut off before it could really gain any traction. So we've had to adjust our programming a little bit in the wake of the pandemic, and we've taken everything online. And we're very much adapting on the fly. You know, we are still a new organization, and we really admittedly didn't have much of a solidified structure before the pandemic. So we're really focusing now on just listening to young people, listening to their concerns, and listening to what they need. So our goals right now are really focused around providing young people with a community. You know, they've just lost all of their extracurricular opportunities. The students that we work with are not just, you know, they're not just going to school from 8 to 2 or whatever it is. They participate in after school clubs and sports and dance, and they have part-time jobs, and a lot of that has been lost now. And so we are hoping that Youth Action on Climate Change will not replace that, but hopefully supplement some of what's been lost. And so just really trying to make sure that young people are staying connected to other youth who are passionate about climate change and staying engaged with climate issues through some new online programming that we're facilitating.
Well, it certainly sounds like you have your hands full with all these projects. I mean, you're the executive director and founder of this Youth Action on Climate Change, a graduate student, you help with a podcast, and on top of all that, you founded a travel blog. Just tell us a little bit more about Airplanes and Avocados. Like, where did the name for that come about?
So Airplanes and Avocados, my travel brand, my baby. I've had it for about 4.5 years now, and the name came about actually because originally when I started it, I was vegan and plant-based and super into health and fitness. And so initially when it started, it was like a travel and health blog. No longer vegan, obviously. And less of a focus on the health and fitness aspect and more so on travel and sustainability. But the Airplanes and Avocados was kind of playing off of this travel and health piece. But yeah, it started 4.5 years ago. And basically, I took a year off between high school and university. I did a bit of traveling and I really fell in love with it. It was kind of like my first experience with overseas travel. And I fell in love with it. I wasn't quite ready to go to university, but I did anyway. And so the travel blog was something that I started in my dorm room and was basically just like a way to relive my travel memories, keep things alive. I'd always loved writing. And so it was like a really therapeutic exercise for me, I guess, as well. And allowed me to just escape and reflect on some of these like really great times that I had traveling. And I'm pretty sure my mom was the only one who read it for the first year, but it actually gained traction rather quickly compared to what I thought. And I actually ended up going on my first press trip to the Maldives, actually, which was super surreal and I still can't believe it sometimes, but I went to the Maldives in 2017, so the blog wasn't even a year old at that point. So it was a really, really cool opportunity and kind of showed me like the possibilities of the blog and of the brand and where I could take it. And so I think that's when I really started to get serious about it and grew it into what it is today. And since that trip to the Maldives and since like all of my academic pursuits have kind of come to fruition, I've combined my passion for traveling with my passion for the environment so that Airplanes and Avocados is not just a travel blog anymore, but it's a sustainable travel blog. And so my goal is to, my tagline is to teach people to see the world and save it at the same time. So providing people with resources that help them travel with a purpose and leave minimal environmental impact, give back to local communities, and just have an overall more fulfilling and authentic travel experience for themselves.
Yeah, I noticed on your website that you had a list of places you wanted to visit in 2020. Have any of those plans changed with the pandemic or have they just been postponed?
Yeah, so a lot of them have changed and I have actually like been hesitant to change my 2020 travel schedule because it still doesn't feel real at times. But yeah, actually last month I was supposed to be in the US for a little bit of conference travel that wasn't related to the blog, but to academia. And then I was supposed to be in Jamaica. And then actually I had a really massive trip planned. I was supposed to be leaving in a couple weeks to Hawaii actually. And I was going to be there for a month. And it was actually like my first trip where I had no real plans. All I had booked was a like a round trip ticket. I was going to be there for just under a month. I had no plans, no like press setup. Like I was just kind of going to figure it out as I went and produce some cool content from it. And unfortunately, fairly early, actually, my flights got canceled by the airlines and totally understandable. I think Hawaii is definitely one place that people shouldn't be traveling right now, given what's going on. But I do have another trip planned at the end of August to the Azores Islands off of Portugal. And I'm really, really hoping that I'll be able to go on that. But it should be interesting, I think, to see how travel kind of also shakes out over the next few months and few years. I think it's definitely going to be a while before international travel especially bounces back from this.
Yeah, well, hopefully you get to make up that trip to Hawaii. Have you been before?
Yeah, I love Hawaii. I was actually just there shortly before the pandemic hit in February, and I have a lot of friends in the islands, and I've just fallen in love with it. I'm looking at doing my PhD there, and I usually go once or twice a year, so it's definitely one of my favorite places in the entire world.
Well, Emily, thank you for sharing your story with us, but now the tough part of the interview is over as we are down to the final five questions, and this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show, and we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
Okay, I know these were supposed to be the easy questions, but this one was actually hard. I had to think about it a lot, and I feel like I'm cheating with my answer, but I have to say sharks. I don't think it counts fully, but I love sharks. They made me fall in love with the ocean as a scuba diver. So that's gotta be my answer.
And what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
I think the TED Talk has gotta be it. I mean, it's a pretty cool experience. And like I said, catalyzed a lot of things for me. So it's definitely gotta be the coolest one.
You're currently working on your master's and you said you were thinking of doing your PhD. You'd love to travel, so I'm sure you have an idea, but what is your dream job or dream location that you'd like to work in?
Yeah, I definitely want to continue studying fisheries and seafood value chains, and I've really, yeah, fallen in love with this work and this industry and realize how much work there is to be done. So I definitely want to stay in fisheries, and I think in research specifically, I really have like an appetite for learning, and I've been really, really having a great time at my master's so far. I definitely need to go somewhere warm and somewhere near an ocean, preferably an island. So yeah, like I said, Hawaii would be an ideal PhD location, but anywhere warm near an ocean that I can study fish and seafood would be perfect.
And if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Yeah, I guess this kind of like goes back to the last question about dream job and location, but I would love to do some sort of like comparative seafood value chain analysis of of the seafood value chains in Hawaii and the Azores Islands. Like both of those island chains are very close to my heart, and I would love to live in each place for a little bit. And I think it'd be really interesting to dig into the nuances of those two areas, and compare the differences and similarities in their seafood value chains.
Finally, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Know your local fishermen. I know it's hard, especially if you're landlocked like I am here, but at least try to ask questions, you know, at your seafood counter, wherever you buy your fish from. Ask questions about where your seafood comes from. I think that, you know, in the current situation that we're in, we have a real opportunity to use this pause. And you know, it's forcing us to rethink a lot of things. This pandemic is forcing us to rethink a lot of things and a lot of our systems and our economies and the way that we just live our lives. And I think it could be a moment to radically change our food systems and our seafood systems. And maybe in a post-pandemic world, you know, we can create space for more localized seafood systems that are sustainable and transparent and support small-scale harvesters, provide consumers with high quality seafood that they can feel good about. But I think the first step in all of that is asking questions, and if you're able to, get to know your local fishermen.
Well, Emily, thank you again for coming on the podcast today. It really was a pleasure hearing about you and all the different projects you have going on. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. This was super cool. Yeah, I've been following the podcast for a while, so I'm glad I finally get to be on it. But if people want to get a hold of me, I'm on Twitter at Airplane Avocado, or I have a website, emilydesouza.com. So just my name, where if people want to check out what I'm working on, they can go there as well.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget to head over to our Patreon page and support the podcast if you feel inclined. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 70th episode of The Fisheries Podcast. And remember, know your local fisherman.